Scott Peterson is the Istanbul Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor and a photographer as well for Getty Images. He's covered Iran as the Middle East correspondent for the Monitor, based in Amman, Jordan, then later as the Moscow Bureau Chief. During those years, his coverage stretched from Algiers to Beirut to Tehran, and later all of Russia and Central Asia. Tiny little coverage area. He's the author of, most recently, of this magnum opus, Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. And I'll pass this around today so you guys can flip through it while we're talking. And also, Me Against My Brother, At War in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda in 2000. As a photographer for Getty Images, his work has appeared in major news magazines, including Time, Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, Perry Match, and Le Figaro. So we're delighted he made it back safely from his recent excursion in Libya and Tunisia. And please join me in welcoming Scott Peterson.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Eric, for that introduction, and also for having me at the Boise Center. I'm really, really pleased to be here and to see so many people who are interested in Iran and interested also in this Arab Spring, which has really taken this region by storm over the last 7 or 8 months. It's an extraordinary thing. You know, I've been covering this region really going back to 1990, and for many, many of those years, it was a kind of a quiet time. I mean, you know, there wasn't an awful lot politically that was going on in the Arab nations that we were talking about, that I was covering, and so it really meant that I was able to focus unhindered on Iran. And in fact, this book is based on 30 visits to Iran during the last 15 years. But now, we're not able to get into Iran. Very, very difficult for journalists since the 2009 election and its violent aftermath to get into Iran. But we have a whole new series of stories on the from these Arab revolutions, really across North Africa and across the Middle East. So I kind of today in my talk, I just wanted to connect some of the dots between these events, between Iran and the Arab Spring, and then afterwards, you're welcome to ask questions about any aspect at all of Iran, U.S. policy, or any other things. But what I'll do when I'm first speaking is we'll just talk mostly about the kind of the Arab Spring connections, because that's what's happening right now. That's what you see on your television screen every single day these days. I just got back from Tripoli about a week ago, and Libya is kind of at the moment the one potentially shining example of what may be achieved with these Arab revolutions. But to understand how this all came about, and also to understand how kind of Iran has been a factor in some of these things, we really need to go back to the Islamic Revolution of 1978. This is where history starts for certainly for those in Iran who adhere to the revolution, adhere to the ideas of that revolution. It was very much a people power revolution. It ended 2,500 years of monarchy, but it was done in a way that those who completed it were convinced that this is going to be not only an Islamic republic, but also a republic, one that was in power because of the will of the people. And in fact, that's written into the constitution that really Iran's rulers are meant to rule with the consent of the people of Iran. Now, of course, this is what's created a lot of the difficulties over the last 15 years, especially in Iran, because the will of the people and the will of the leadership, if you will, of the Islamic regime have not always added up. But as an idea, as an example about, you know, what was possible in this region, for many years, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 stood alone as an event that Iranians, in many respects, were very, very proud of. And in fact, you would often hear from Iranians, you know, they would look at all of the other nations of the Middle East, they would look at Arab countries especially and say, you know, all of these guys are sitting underneath their tyrannies, and they're just kind of sitting on their hands, they're not doing anything. These Sunni Arab nations really weren't capable of having the kind of courage, the boldness, the things that we as Iranians were able to achieve in 1979. So Iranians were very, very dismissive of how Arabs handled their own regimes. So if we fast forward now to 2009, now this is obviously 30 years later, and the regime's relationship with its people has changed quite dramatically over all of these years. We had the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. This, you know, kind of deepened some of the religious and ideological aspects of the revolution, turned it into a much more Shiite at the Shiite Muslim event, but also looking forward still further to the election of President Mohammad Khatami, the rise of the reformist movement inside Iran. These were things that were surprising political developments in Iran, but that were a function of people expressing themselves and feeling that they had a say in who was leading them in Iran. Of course, inside Iran, despite all the lip service which is paid to a democratic and kind of a populist worldview, constitutionally again, the religious aspects and the religious leader, the supreme religious leader, has the final say on all things going. So there's always been tension between what the supreme leader of Iran would want and dictate, and also what may or may not be the popular view, the direction that Iran should go in. These things were manifest, especially starting in 1979, with the election of President Khatami, and we saw this. A very, very large popular mandate for his presidency. The reformists came and went. This is the thumbnail version. The reformists came and went. They were defeated ultimately by conservatives, who finally took control of the leadership and presidency of Iran in 2005 with President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Even then, it wasn't a complete victory. This didn't mean that conservatives had complete grip or complete control over everything. But what it did do was it set up a new dynamic in which you had a very, very populist leader, and we can talk much more about how he actually operates, President Ahmadinejad, in his relationships with, as a populist politician. I mean, unlike any that Iran has seen, certainly that has been in the Islamic Republic over the last 32 years. He's a politician like no other, in fact, which is part of his charm for some of his supporters, but also one of the weaknesses that he has in terms of the threat that he presents to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In any event, the election of 2009 was a watershed, because in this presidential election, there was a big surge of popular support for the opposition candidate, who is right there, Mir Hossein Mousavi, just to the left of President Khatami there. There's a big surge in the last 10 days or so before the election. And I think that the regime, when they basically permitted Mousavi to run for the presidency, they felt that this man who had been, for nearly a decade, had been the prime minister in the 1980s, he was a very boring, uncharismatic individual. So really, they didn't think that there would be too much of a threat. But as people began to think or realize that if they voted for him, that he might become kind of a reformist type savior. The word savior came up again and again. I heard this on the streets of Tehran and other cities, from people who might otherwise vote for conservatives. They felt, well, if we vote for this guy, we can actually change some of the things that are going on in Iran. So there was this huge surge in the last few days before he won. You had, 16-year-old Iranian, girls who'd be out on the streets screaming as if the Beatles were like next door for this guy who literally had been dismissed completely by Iran's ruling elite as someone who could galvanize the opposition. So anyway, huge surge. The election took place, and probably the only official statistic of the election that was accurate was that came from the official figures was that of the turnout, which was said to be 85%. That is a huge, huge turnout. And I can assure you, having watched over a dozen elections in Iran, that Iranians, like most people around the world, don't really turn up to like re-elect the incumbent. They turn up to kick out the incumbent because they're so angry with whatever his policies were. And we heard this again and again. So, lo and behold, this election takes place. Many of those 85% of the people who turned out felt that when the results were actually announced, that Ahmadinejad had somehow swept to a 2-1 landslide victory, that something was very, very wrong here. And so they took to the streets in what became the first street protest, pro-democracy protest that we saw in this region for decades. Literally, there had been street fights that had gone on in Iran before 1999 with the students. We had other violence for a few days in 2003. There were episodes, but nothing like this, where you have an entire, what appeared to be a huge, large portion of the population that were galvanized to go out onto the street to complain. And of course, the question they asked was, where's my vote? That was the question. This, some people describe that as a new revolution. Some people described it as a Twitter revolution, a Facebook revolution. It probably wasn't any of those things in reality, but all of those things contributed. This election in 2009 and the aftermath, how the protests were carried out, how people chose to gather and how they mobilized, you know, this was the first time that we saw Twitter, Facebook, and other things in action, and it completely took the Islamic regime, the Nizam, by surprise. They were just not expecting that these mobilizing tools, you know, existed for people. So they were really caught off guard. It took them many weeks before they could, you know, kind of come to terms with those things. They shut off the text messaging systems. They, you know, slowed the internet down to a crawl if they didn't shut it down. And then they applied very, very repressive tactics, killing people, raping people, arresting more than 4,000 people in the first 10 days of this election, after the election, and really demonstrated that they would go to any extent to crack down on this, what was then called the Green Movement. So, in Iran in 2009, we have an example first of a people power pro-democracy protest, and we also have on the other side an example for repressive regimes in the region of what can be done to block, stop, squish that kind of opposition. So, now, fast forward to these Arab nations that have been sitting around for decades underneath their tyrants, and we often used to joke as journalists, we're like, you know, because Iran was always full of kind of political ferment. You could always talk to people, and you know, people were never afraid to speak their minds. It's still the case. I mean, you know, from the outside, it might look like Iran's a closed police state. Inside Iran's people are bubbling away, talking. But in Iraq, I made 15 visits to Iraq during Saddam's time before 2003. And in all of those 15 visits, there was only one time that one Iraqi actually told me that, if you know, took me aside and said, you know, if we didn't have these sanctions, then, you know, didn't have to think about our stomachs, then we would actually be able to do something about this horrible guy. One person, one time during 15 visits. So it gives you an idea about how successful a regime like Saddam's was in basically keeping their people from doing anything. So we used to joke, we used to think, well, if you were Iraqi, for example, what do you think you thought when you were, like, you know, coming of age when you were 17 or 18? You just think, well, I guess I drew the short straw. I guess it won't be my generation that does anything. Just sit on your hands and do nothing. So all of a sudden, we have this incredibly galvanizing event in Tunisia, where this young college graduate who's basically forced hopelessly and helplessly to kind of sell vegetables and is given, you know, is basically told by, you know, by a policeman, you're not up to legal standard or whatever scratch it was. And he realized that there was nothing that he could do, and therefore conducted the act that has now galvanized every single one of these Arab revolutions. He immolated himself. There is no footage that I'm aware of this event, but as an idea, as a thought of an internal protest, it caught fire every place. And what's extraordinary is that, you know, this kind of event, you know, we know what the hurly-burly of politics are in the Middle East in many respects. This could have happened and gone completely unnoticed. Just a tree falling in the forest, and no one may have paid attention. But the fact that it took place, the fact that it just in this instance caught fire, began to tap into the deepest resentments and the deepest yearnings across the Middle East. So, what we began to see in Tunisia, what we then began to see take root in Egypt, what we began to see take root in Libya, and now, of course, Syria and Yemen and Bahrain and other places, began to look an awful lot like the protests in 2009. They used some of the same techniques, they used some of the, and you know, they looked the same. That's not to say that the dots were connected, that's not to say that the Tunisians said, well, see, the Iranians tried but failed in 2009 to do this, maybe we should try it. But as a, you know, as kind of a mechanism of what you can do, what may be possible in terms of getting people out, Iran really did provide, in many respects, that template. Now, it's interesting, of course, I make that case and that argument. The Iranians these days, too, make a similar argument. I mean, the Supreme Leader himself has declared all of these Arab revolutions, not all of them, but he's declared many of them to be part of an Islamic awakening. he says that, you know, all of these Arabs are now learning from the example of 1979. This is the export of the revolution, which is, of course, something that Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the leader of that revolution, always said needed to happen. We must export the revolution. So a generation later, this is finally happening. So, of course, he's putting a nice gloss on what's actually happening. Because from his perspective, they're all Islamic awakenings as long as they are taking down pro-Western tyrants and dictators. But if it comes to taking down a pro-Iranian dictator, like, for example, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, well, that's sedition. I don't call that people power, and that's not Islamic awakening, that's sedition. In the same way that all those Iranian pro-democracy protests in 2009 weren't Democrats. Those people were seditionists. They were the enemy. They were all the things that were evil in trying to undermine the regime. So Iran, of course, is trying to have it both ways. The Supreme Leader is trying to put a polishing gloss on the events that are going on. But I think that one of the probably most informative cartoons that I saw at that time when Mubarak fell in Cairo and we had Iran's Supreme Leader describing this as an Islamic awakening, it was a great cartoon in which basically you had Khamenei standing up next to a domino that said Tunisia on it. Gave it a push, and the next one was Egypt, you know, and then they went. But they went in a circle. And so behind him, right, was another cleric who's like, you know, because it's coming around to hit Iran. And I really think that in the same way that Iran, perhaps in 1979, but I think more importantly in 2009, affected people's thinking about what was possible in terms of kind of mass protests and, you know, what it looked like, I think that ultimately now the lessons are going to start going the other way. Because you've got a lot of Iranians who failed in 2009 to sufficiently change their regime, now looking over at these Arabs who for 30 years have been sitting on their hands and saying, "Geez, they've done it in Tunisia, they've done it in Egypt, they've done it in Libya. What about us?" So I think that that's, you know, we'll see. But I think eventually that domino is going to come and it's going to affect the Iranians too. Should probably leave it there.